Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Pocahontas, the Indian, I suppose, princess, as she's been anglicized or converted into European culture. And I'm just going to talk about it. Now, the situation is that I'm off doing rehab, where I've got sort of exercises and, you know, it's pushing every single day to improve. And what I've done is I've mixing, remembering about New Scientist articles that I've read, and looking at documentaries and study them and then talk about them. So the last documentary I did was yesterday, was the feral cats, where I reported about the 2 million feral cats and the general information about them. And hopefully some information goes in. It's not so much how long I recover, it's the sort of the structuring of the information. And I don't know, it's a big fight on how to write good communication, and I've just began doing luminosity, and that's a bit of a crusher. Yeah, there's some good memory skills, but the other skills are just not up. You know, they're disastrous, dreadful. It could well be so luminosity, and I think it's called Elevate, to brain training apps, and they give you feedback, unfortunately, about how you're doing. And I don't know, sort of like a lot of the problems I do, I can think about and think up strategies. They tend to sort of really just punish your brain. And I think, so I'm going for two aspects. One is for long walks and training up till you, I suppose, get fatigued and get good sleep, and to try and mix those two together. So there's two, this sort of like there's a trifecta of things that you have to do for brain recovery. One is, and they've all got to, I suppose, or two of them have to be up at a rate which is a reasonable challenge. One is cognitive work of sufficient variety and association and different aspects to go across, and sufficiently challenging and engaging. That is, you can do dull computer games, but they're not as engaging as trying to, and they take sort of more, the more sort of like a tiny skill and focus it. Whereas if you're working on a project or something which requires a whole lot of integration of skills, that requires a little bit more to push ahead. Then there's exercise, and essentially that has to be at a sufficient intensity and complexity to be worthwhile. And finally, there's sleep. And fortunately, you, if you're allowed to, you can get enough of that. But it's also, you've got to, I suppose, not have worries or not think about them. So those three factors come together, and as you're exploring, you're saying, oh, well, look, I probably need different skills. And so you really need an area to research, and then contemplate, and then try and communicate sort of full in, full out about it. And so this is it. This is the sort of the background to it. And I've pulled up an NSS documentaries online, and sort of look at the topic. Is if it's sort of easily doable. It's not all spread all over the place and not too visual. It's got a factor in a single topic. So the first one was feral cats. The second one is Pocahontas. Now, Pocahontas is really unknown to Australians. There's a Disney thing, and you heard of John Smith a little bit, and someone in sort of the Disney princess with a I suppose American Indian, native Indian, or First Nations face and features and colouring, and wearing the classic Indian dress. So that's something that is sort of, I suppose, acceptable. Wear a dress, and there's some general things about her. That's about all you really know. That's some sort of romance, and you do have the word John Smith in there. And so going on this thing, there's a series of strands of information to say about her. And she basically dies in the on the Thames in at the age of 22. So this is probably about 15. Oh, I was trying to think where she's around the time. I've got to try and work this out, because there's as I get facts and information in, it doesn't quite make sense to me. So some of the dates and times there. So in 1492, is that right? 1492. Oh yeah, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and he, with using capital raised by Queen Isabella and the Spanish kings. So if you ought to really understand, compared to the what is it, to the Roman cultures and stuff like that, these are a much more new kingdom. So Spain's a relatively new kingdom in the place, and so it's sort of like the Wild West. It's sort of, Spain is like a proto-America of Europe. So if you've got Central Europe, and like Spain's the first version of America, sort of entrepreneurial, going out, still going out. And I think Columbus would work well. I think Columbus is Italian. It's my, well, shows how little I know about him. And to my surprise, he didn't go out there once. He went out there several times in the establishment of the Spanish in the more southern areas, and essentially the basic thing was that if you go there, it's likely that you'd find gold. And so Columbus established a gold mine, and took slaves, and basically was just a pretty, from what I can see, a pretty rotten person. But, you know, again, people, we didn't really know that he went out, what, as an Australian, not knowing, I didn't know that he went several times across the seas there. And then there's the competition between the Spanish and the English, and there are several things happening in terms of that, that the Spanish has sort of got the Americas going, but the American information that that England really had to go over to Spain really didn't get going. I said, it's also interesting to see how the Spanish, I think it couldn't have been the Habsburgs back then, but how the Spanish kings got up and got in relationships with various things. The English, I think, captured a Spanish galleon. And that single galleon, that's the galleon, one of those ships, was carrying more gold than the entire English treasury. And this sort of went back to them and said, and they're going, the penny dropped, the gold coin dropped, that, you know, we better get out there and start up things. And you've got the sort of the famous headline act in the next line of history, is the Plymouth Rock, the English and the Dutch going out there. And the English, we know in 1514, went, I think that's the word, don't quote me on that one. Look, I'm just an Aussie going through this, trying to memorize these things, get these facts together. They went over in these rental ships, and so these people from England raised money and rented a ship, basically, and they rented two ships. But one ship was unseaworthy, and so they had all crammed on the Mayflower, and they basically just barely survived in more northern what's it, Plymouth. I don't know what the geography of the United States is. At least I do know they survived by stealing corn supplies. So not only did the Indians have corn, that they had middens, or what we call, or supplies of it. So the North Americans, besides having primitive use of metal, also had agriculture. And this is sort of like a bit in stark contrast to our Australian Aborigines, who didn't employ agriculture. Now, again, sort of the population density and a whole lot of factors, weather and, I don't know, just the ability to hunt, meant that the Indians had a lot of agriculture there. Now, the interesting thing is, sort of pointed out that the English were sending out several companies there. So, a bit like the Dutch, these companies would set up and finance a group of people to go over there, the ships, build the ships to go over there, and it would be speculative. And basically, the company would go out, what do you find, and, you know, how it's actually unfolded would be what the company's putting out. And so, Virginia, under the court of James the First, so it's James Stewart. I can't quite work out. So Elizabeth I dies. So the court of King James is importantly around the time of Shakespeare, and around importantly also around the time of Francis Bacon. Now Francis Bacon, very important. My lexicon is the founding key person in science, and he basically, as you look at the different points of methodologies and inquiries, he had the sort of the intellectual method to take science from just an observational, practical thing to move on to a higher level by inductive thinking. So he had the science idea, and his theories and ideas really set up the United States, the method of the United States, and his basic doctrine was part of the legal charter, which got some of these colonies going. So before the 1514, I don't know, roughly, the founding, the pilgrims, who weren't the first one, there was actually other European settlements before. In 1507, if I remember correctly, they set up a institution, a fort of Jamestown. Jamestown? James. We've got Jamestown here. It's Jamestown, Virginia. And they set up basically a triangular fort on sort of, I suppose, an island. It was around the Delaware River. So, all these things I really don't understand. Now, apparently the water wasn't very good. There was abundant wildlife, but they had none of the know-how to transfer from being in a sort of highly populated, interdependent, large economy of England to go right... to go right back and actually fend for themselves. So they got up in the in the United States, so they travelled across the Atlantic in a boat or two boats and set up this fort of a few hundred people. I think it was 160, 180 people. And essentially, pestilence and disease, they weren't, I suppose, very well off. They couldn't get any food, and there was a sort of a renegade, self-made man. Turned out to be a bit of a tyrant further on the place, but was able to be just basically the original Donald Trump, I would say, in terms of saying, I know what to do, and people who are fractured and so tired really can't put anything up against him. And he went out hunting for food, and going out, and he, as I showed in the documentary, went out, and there's the Algonquin Indians, and there's the, still in Canada, there's the Algonquin National Park, the Cree Indians, the Algonquin tribe. So I don't quite understand how this goes. Now, sort of really rather strange, that, I've got this sort of odd relationships with, on several accounts with Native American Indians, but I don't know. It's not an intellectual thing. So I'll just quickly go over my relationship with the Cree Indians. So they're up around Toronto, and I was just mulling around a employment exhibition with my wife. I was there having a postdoc in Toronto, and I just chatted with these people. I said, look, yeah, to be quite honest, I don't understand how these Canadians function. It's just a little bit beyond. And then they just adopted me. And I used to hang out with them a few times, go up canoeing through the huge numbers of waterways all the way up there. And they'd just tell me a few stories and stuff like that. And so there's that, and there's sort of another similar incident, with just sort of not being part of the American culture, not getting it, and so I think once you said, look, I don't really understand what's going on, and that take you in. And this is also in I think it was San Francisco when I was a kid. My father similarly went out with these people. So I sort of got a very base, sort of quizzical, sort of, I don't know, understanding of what's going on. So you had these people coming up, and John Smith single-handedly living the dream, sort of like a Rambo, decides I'll go out, and he tries to take on 50 Indians or sort of Native Americans, and he's captured and taken from village to village. So this is quite a civilization here, with settled villages and territories and political structure, and he's taken up to Paladin, the king of the head of the Indians. And what's interesting is in this story, he is 22, and Pocahontas, which is her nickname, which means spoilt child, is one of the many daughters of the king, I think called Paladins. Now, this is really interesting because there's someone called Paladins in the Voltron. So I've just been watching that. I must admit, when I was sick, and before the modern Voltron came on with Rhys Darby and the sort of iconic colouring, sort of computerised colouring, which is sort of just so absorbing to watch, they had the old Voltron, and the old Voltron was just so bad. I just really enjoyed it, but they had the Paladin in that. But this person was chief, it sounded a bit like Paladin, and his sons were Paladins, and so there was a sort of like a hierarchy class through marriage associated with it. And I pointed out this priest, the king was of the Indians, the head of the chief of the Indians was highly intelligent and quite sophisticated. And now there's a story that, which is the, sort of the central myth of Pocahontas and the John Smith was about to have his head smashed in a rock. And just as the clubs were coming up, Pocahontas allegedly put herself between the person with the club and the person, and that this saviour meant that eventually Pocahontas was credited with interceding and stopping the bloodshed. And then the king sort of adopted him as his son, which is really making yourself a special envoy. And so he could come back and the English could trade with the Indians. And of course what they really were after is establishing a trade relationship with them so they could eventually get weapons off the English. That's what they're really after. But they had to sort of start somewhere. And in this, the central legend of Pocahontas saving John Smith has got several problems with him, in that John Smith was a, as described, a fantasist, someone who would just blow up his exploits. And look, there's many things in the Victorian era. There was fantasists, there's Biggles, war heroes. And so what's happened is that I really believe that we've got the Marvel studio, and so that's really sort of the Marvel. True fantasy has actually killed this self-made fantasy. And so the issue is, unfortunately, that this John Smith has in serial places said the same issue, the same legend with different protagonists in different cultures. Each time the culture was going to smash him up, and the princess put through their selves in their way, and essentially in his writing he writes nothing about this, because he has a diary and it's, you know, there's great interest in selling this back in Britain. So it's not only the actual story, but it's also the information. So if you can imagine, it's sort of like going to the moon, and the information comes back in England. And so he writes nothing of this legend until everyone associated with it has died. You can't say he's wrong, and he sort of introduces this idea. So the actual central legend isn't there. Now, this sort of central legend of the Indians saving the white people is sort of like saying, well, in essence, there's this feeling that the whites are supposed to be there and are protected in a way and have the rite of passage. And so this is really important, because they point later on in the documentary, this is out of order, to depictions of this, and this is in the Capitol building. So you know the big Capitol building, the big dome, which everyone says, oh, the United States of America. And it used to be that I think my four-year-old kid would recognize this, and he would say, the government, I love the government. And so, you know, that's the center of power. Inside, there's this big dome. And you look up, and it's sort of got a quasi-religious viewpoint up there. And the documentary, I was really surprised, because they actually zoomed in on what you would see, which, with your poor eyesight, at such a distance, oh, that's God. Got up there. No, it's actually George Washington as God. You know, oh, my God. But looking around are the legend, mythic stories, a bit like the American legends around the outside there. And there's several friezes of Pocahontas throwing herself in front of John Smith. So John Smith is a bit of a rogue, a vagabond, and he's got a very strong, or let's say a bit bit later on. So the Pocahontas comes over, and she begins to learn English, and she teaches Algonquin, which is the language, to John Smith, and he writes it down. And when he writes down, we have the only really written record of Pocahontas, which is a 12-year-old girl, and they said that she liked playing with the other children there, and she was particularly good at doing cartwheels, which the other English people didn't see. So you give an idea of about how young she was, and she would have basic lessons and learn English. And this is important, that she could speak English, he could speak Algonquin. It was the main way of getting money out. And they said, oh, well, John Smith, you're so great, you can run this place. And what actually happened was that he became an absolute fascist tyrant and said, if you don't work, you can't eat. So he turned it into a nice little possum around the place. He turned it into sort of a nightmare state, and he was so hated in the way that he ran this place that eventually everyone kicked him out and injured, and there's a series of him being kicked out and eventually been taken by the Indians again, and then chucked out again, and eventually in disgrace, sort of going back to England on a ship. So he sort of exits. So this John Smith turns out to be firstly, he's much older, 10 years older than Pocahontas, and also 12 years older than him, and also not such a nice person overall, as judged by his peers. And he goes out, and of course, without this, Pocahontas isn't there, the relationship with the Indians go down, they begin to starve, and I'm not quite sure if this is the exact sequence, because it goes through several sequences, the people get really thing, and they eventually cook their belts and their food, and they eat everything. And when they were recently excavating Jamestown, they excavated some of the graves, and they were able to look at the actual markings, the actual knife markings from the butchery of the people there. And so as the people died, they actually cannibalized them. They were that starving, that deeply starving. So this sort of deep taboo of cannibalism is right there at the start. Even as the founding fathers are still setting sail, they're eking their own. And it was all going to change as the East Virginia Company. So you can imagine that the raising of money will get up, and people get money for raising money, so they take a cut of it, so it's sort of like a bubble, and it's pushing across. And so these five ships go across just to save these people, and there's a horrible storm. They lose all the the money? So they lose all the supplies. So the people arrive, and they're there, and they begin to double stuff. I think during that time, it's that time when the second fleet comes in there. They survive. They starve, and there's one person with plague, and plague, you know, coming across that plus the plague. So it goes in, sort of everybody dies. It's a pretty awful thing. Now, we'll just do parallels with Australian history. The John Smith and Major Ross. So Major Ross, there's Major Ross and George Johnson. Okay, George Johnson is pretty much the same caliber as John Smith in terms of he's a fantasist and sort of tries to build up his own reputation. I don't know how that operates, quite frankly, but so George Johnson is an Australian. And this is in 1788, coming across. And he sort of big notes himself and creates the legend. And all of the legend which Australians take as the gospel, similarly, are taken from our George Johnson. But there's also a Major Ross. And I'm just trying to think, what is it Captain Ross? No, Major Ross. So he's the head of the New South Wales detachment. And he's got as much imagination and man management skills as John Smith when he takes control. And Major Ross is so dreadful that he really is the great founding father of Australia, in that all the other officers who have got any spine, any moral, can't stand him and say, look, I think I might stay out here in Australia. Goodbye, because he's such an awful, awful person. And so this sort of expulsion of the person back to England is sort of similar there. Also similarity is we had the first fleet of 13 ships, two Royal Navy ones and 11 rental ships. So we had the two Royal Navy ones stick around and the 11s just went off to get sunk and do all their trading and so they're basically trade vessels. And then the second fleet came up with more people and cut cost. So the cut cost was they wrote a contract. You have to deliver so many people. They didn't say if they had to be dead or alive. They went up there and I think the supply ship hit an iceberg because they'd go up to icebergs to get water going down to Australia, and the iceberg sank, and part of the control, you could have less troops on ship to stop mutiny, because if you mutinied, you had no food, you had to be resupplied from the supply ship, and of course the supply ship sank, and everyone was absolutely stuffed. They hit absolutely half dead Sydney Harbour. It's interesting that it was called Semicircular Quay, because Circular Quay, you couldn't get into a circle, could you? Yeah, if it was a quay, it was totally circular, you couldn't get it. So it used to be called Semicircular Quay. They'd go in there, and nowadays it's a rectangle, because it's all been shaped. So, Circular Quay, how does this happen? But it's just a combination of, history and, abbreviation. So that came in here and basically all starving, not enough food, and the colony was already starving, and they were all going, in fact I think they may have had a feast or something like that. You know, they're coming, it's all okay, but then a bit of a shock. And so I think that was the first Sydney Hospital, one of the first things they built. We're going to have to build something to house all these sick people, and pretty much the same thing happened in that these ships that had dreadful storms, lost all the supplies, limped into Jamestown. It's absolutely cactus. So they kick out John Smith, and at a certain time they were going to I think they get down to 35 people from several hundred, 500 down to 35 people, and they say, we're leaving. They get on a ship and pack up and go. But as they go, they meet a visionary governor who's coming over to Virginia to set it up again. And they set it up fully. So here, John Smith has gone for a while. And there's a second John. Oh, this is my name. I'm trying to remember it. John R. something, John Rawlson, Rowell, John Rawl, something like that. So he's there, and what they do is Pocahontas comes and an English captain captures her for ransom, and puts her in a ship for a while, several days, and then eventually she comes back in as a hostage, and they're converted to Christianity, Anglifier, baptizer. So she's baptized in the Church of England. Of course, this is one of the existential threats to it. One is that they wanted to get wealth, and they also wanted to give the native world there. It's a very primitive view, sort of, you know, right back. Oh, a Native American shot an arrow at me. So what they knew is that they were savages. They deserved to die, be fought. They deserved to have their land taken away. And they're very violent. So you've got all this thing going back to Elizabeth England. It's sort of a horror. But they knew they had to get money. And the Spanish were converting them to Catholicism, no worries. So there's this issue. So it's hugely significant to have there. She was already speaking English. And it's George Rrr. Geez, not George Rrr. John, another John. And it's really interesting the number of Johns that were there. It's been a popular birth name. And so he, I'm still talking about this. So he, wrote to the governor. So it's now a bit more of a structure happening here, a governor. And, writes in, I'm really in love with this chicky babe. Going to make it big in Disney one day. I am a different John though, but I'm sure the textbooks aren't going to make be too fuzzy about it. And they marry, and they have a child. And more importantly is that the stupid tobacco that they're trying to grow, he somehow gets the Spanish tobacco, which is a much better tobacco. It's not sort of like, I was just trying to think of a, it's sort of like it's the difference between, I would expect, I don't smoke tobacco, but it would be the difference between top side, rump, Wagyu beef, you know, this fantastic, you know, melt in your mouth beef, and corn silver side. So pretty much the same animal, but completely different treated. Tastes really slimy, blah. And so he made this, and this tobacco grew really quickly and started the plantations. Now, of course, this is seen as good in a way, but bad in another way, because the plantations required workers, which required slaves, and the plantations grew. They mean they didn't have food, and it's sort of like the end of the Indians was this plantation. But she was there, and she had their son and toddler, went off to the United States, so went off in a boat and went back to England. Now, there's many similar stories of Aboriginals and people going off to England. I want to say the side story of the English being fascinated with the Hawaiians and getting the king and queen of the Hawaiians to go to England, and they feted them, they had operas, you know, clapped hands and all this type of stuff. You are great. They had things, and they said, come and visit all our measles hospitals, and they visited them and then caught measles and died. So this is a sort of like a little taste of what's coming through. So this has often happened. It's sort of this bringing disease and smallpox and all these dreadful, dreadful things to the New World. Of course, I've got to really work through this and give you a taste of what's coming through. So she's completely Anglified. I think she's got a name of Rebecca. I wish I could remember the second name. So it's John and Rebecca. Pocahontas, she does forget it. But she is an Algonquin Indian. And they married. She's very beautiful, apparently. And they have a child. And so this is still, you know, 18, you know, 20, Bob 19. You know, this is all happening, you're building, and it's getting very wealthy. And of course, tobacco coming across. There's a number of things that you've got your original tobacco marketing company. Now, it is really interesting how these commercial companies, which we say are awful, have affected world history. The one thing which is the most central thing affecting world history at the moment, in terms of my neck of the woods, is Carlsberg beer. And you say, well, how did they do it? Well, Carlsberg beer had money, and they bought themselves, they set up a beer institute, a Royal Copenhagen Institute. So the Copenhagen royalty was sort of rather a bit rural, downtrodden and stuff like that. Denmark's a lovely country. They did make beer, and the money came in there, and they said, well, look, we'll set this up, and we'll put a soccer player in charge of it all, which is Niels Bohr. And there really wasn't the intellectual depth in there. And so it's had to have some good scores pretty early on. And so it made some sort of pretty dodgy ideas about the atom. And guess what? Using some pretty crazy ideas. And guess what? That's what we teach our kids today. We are teaching the beer company version of it. In America, although it's sort of structured on tobacco money, you know, this is, you know, it's essentially these companies went over there. So you had the extraction of English society, these companies setting it up, and this marketing of America back is sort of like an echo chamber, where the marketing concept of America is what is the basis of America. Sort of unlike our country, which is some sort of river, you know, basically, if you look at us, Australia, being a penal colony, it's all about emancipation and servitude and social structure, social penal colonies here, and the idea of escaping and making it good, and not really getting about stewardship of the environment. It's sort of serving your time, doing it. Well, yeah, there's sort of a criminal element. There's a criminal element in the under this, the sort of the knowledge, this is in Australian society. It's sort of like there's the surface culture of a prison, and then there's the thuggery underneath it, where people control the clothes and the workshop things, and there's this secondary prison hierarchy within. So you've got the official hierarchy in Australia, which is, you know, the government, blah, 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 blah. And then there's a second hierarchy, which is the prison hierarchy, which is sort of a bit by stealth. I don't know. Can't quite put it like it there. But the critical thing is that if this sort of secondary political thing exists, this sort of a parallel thing, I can't quite describe it. So what it essentially means is that we will say, oh, we're going to build an airport. People who scream, okay, you're not in our party. People who like us, you're in our party. We're going to put in infrastructure spending, which we would have had to spend anyway to upgrade Sydney anyway, because it's part of modernisation. But we're now going to say we're going to reward our group for going with us. If you're not in the right electorate and you don't vote for the group within the prison structure which can actually do it, you get sort of, you miss out on things. So the idea is that obviously there is a sensible way to put in roads and build up Sydney, but it's actually going patchwork along the electorates, because they say, we go with the airport or part of that. So there's a sort of this superficial structure, but underneath it there's a way of undermining it. So what happens here is that we say, okay, well, what don't we like about this group, their particular party, but they're also in a high bushfire zone. Okay, what we're going to change the rule is that people in high bushfire zones have to pay for their all the bushfire burden. Okay, well, we didn't think of that before. We thought, you know, it was a sort of a part of our national debt, but now we're going to say, staff living in Australia, if you live in a bushfire zone, you have the entire burden of paying for all the bushfire structure. Okay, and this is sort of slightly different in terms of that. It just really doesn't. I suppose it's there, and it means that this structure, this thing, which is in the area, the prison population that you don't like, is now burdened. That's sort of very hard for them to negotiate their way out. Oh my God, Father. Oh God, this is going to be such a big, so I'm just walking down Glenbrook Gorge at the moment. So you've got this sort of crazy thing going on. So it's the Americans who've got this other things that with you, if you're not with the company or not with the company viewpoint, it's not going up. So you've got to really understand that you've got these founding fathers coming in, but you've also got these companies going in, the Europeans going in, and like Europe, I suppose, I mean, one can't hold Europe to account for being hundreds of years from behind the time, because they are hundreds, this Europe of hundreds of years ago. So you have the worst elements coming out, and they don't have modern media, they have no scrutiny, they have no press, so to speak. So the Virginia Tobacco Company takes out Pocahontas and dresses her up, puts her around England and says, you know, this is a native, but look, us tobacco people are making them Christian, they're dressing up as English, they're speaking English, what's the problem? Give us some more money, we'll do, invest in us, and we will rip the Indians off even more. And there was this thing that the actual John Smith, and the Disney John Smith, was in England and tried to approach Pocahontas, and said, and she said, and so there's the recorded words of Pocahontas in the books, the English Algonquin books of John Smith, and then years later there's the reported Pocahontas speech in here, and she said, "Well, you basically sold out the us North American Indians. Thank you very much." Oh, well, I wouldn't say. If I don't know what the Algonquin for fuck off is, but she probably said that to him. And he's this classic people who want to reinvent themselves, trying to reinvent himself right to the end. And so she was there, and sort of classic marketing. At a certain point in time, where's the North American Indian going? Back to North America with the happy thing, and they travel along, and now by the Thames, you got to understand how filthy London was. The stench of shit. You imagine North America, it sort of smelled quite nice, and scribbles gone, this, it was wilderness, a bit, stuff like that, streams flowing, stuff like that, you know. And you go to London, it would have stank to high heaven. Oh, yeah, I was going to say that story of the original ships going back for the Second Fleet there, which is, I call them Second Fleet, in Australia we call it Second Fleet, that was taken on by Shakespeare in The Tempest. So I think I would really like to try and see how Shakespeare got the ships and the Tempest, the feel of the sea. That would be a fantastic play to see. What you very rarely really hear about it. Tempest, what a fantastic story here. So, So you've got Pocahontas after she has been in England, and obviously there's a lot more recording going on, and meeting various people, and the tobacco industry. She's there in the ship, and then everyone starts to get violently sick while the ship's in the Thames before it's even leaving London, and she dies at 22 in the ship's hold, and the John comes back, and the son is left in England, and he goes back. They two never meet again. He goes back to live up the life of whatever it is. Obviously, he's probably getting another wife. Now, this is really interesting in terms of this thing. You've just got to try and work out what this culture is. So people at the top of these cultures get to go through the wives, because the wives don't live very long, so I'll get on my next one. And obviously, it means that someone else obviously is missing out on wives big time. And this is an interesting thing to look, if you look at the maths of wives in the Australian colonies. You've got John Collins, who has gone through, I think he's gone up to 5 wives, and sort of Macquarie comes back. So in Australia, things absolutely go potty. There's a rebellion by incompetent people, and they send out a Governor Macquarie, who's, I don't know, everyone loves him. There's Macquarie University and all this type of stuff. But this is going back to Australia, and he says, look, everyone, you've got to get married, and we've got to have one wife. And so they had this really complex marriage system. So what happens is that this John a pirate. I'm going to start ascending the gorge, the other side of the gorge. I'm going across the footbridge at the moment, going up here. He sends the wealth back. Son comes over, is super wealthy, and marriages, and it's important. The marriages from his children are important in American society, because people say you go back to Pocahontas. And Pocahontas becomes really important, because Pocahontas is used to sell tobacco. So it's Pocahontas tobacco. So tobacco, she is really a brand of cigarette. It's sort of pretty amazing from England. And so you see these pictures, and it's Pocahontas tobacco. And of course, there's still the story is you've got a bit of a legend plucked out by John Smith, writing about how Pocahontas saved him. And it is unlikely that he would have died, because the king, even at this stage, was working out, I could kill him, or I could use him to get the weapons out of the English, the hapless English there, who are starving themselves to death. And I think the American Indians were thinking, what are these people coming up here and starving? If they're coming out here to starve, they must be completely starving in in England. And essentially, is this intelligence stuff. And so when Pocahontas and John, or it's called Rebecca and John, or something, went to England, the king also sent other native envoys with them, and they gathered intelligence, who came back to try and describe to him what the English were. Were they all starving? Those basic questions come across. So fast forwarding, the sun comes up and starts a lineage, a royal lineage in the US of the Pocahontas story. So the Pocahontas story is so important, it's actually in the center of Australia, of the American government. Up there, the pictures there. And a whole lot of people were claiming Pocahontas as sort of like the mythical royal lineage. Now, there wasn't really a concept of princesses in and princes in American Native society, so a lot of that is just transported across transferred across, rightly or wrongly. But so you can see little elements of European culture, ideas been melded into this, like the tobacco company and this entire thing coming along. Now, in 1924, a white supremacist in Virginia brought into law the definition of colour. So you are coloured if you're non-white, and you're non-white if you have even a drop of native blood in your lineage. Okay, this sounds great, 1924, but I must admit, reading sort of original documents from around the time, up at the top of the Bailey Library at Melbourne University, it's sort of like, for goodness sake, I'd go up with the people and we'd read guides to London in 1924. The whole of Europe and America was just full of absolutely crazy racist people, and the idea was that it then created an alarm, because a whole lot of the top of wealthy American society had written in books and everything connection to Pocahontas, you know, it was suddenly, oh my God, what a clanger. And so they just added an addendum to it. You mustn't have a drop of American, sort of North American native in your blood at all, ever. You know, even the smallest amount. And except for Pocahontas. Therefore, all the other American, wealthy Americans are off the hook. And so there's a bit of a story for it. And this race rule, so the importance of this is an interracial marriage, between it. And this came up to 1967. That's just too late. It's beyond my comprehension if they said 1967. A few kilometres, 100 kilometres away from, Jamestown, the, Virginia had on its statute you couldn't have interracial marriages. And, had these two people, white person fell in love with a mixed race. And it's interesting now because we've got, what's the first name? Meikle? I've really forgotten the name of the royals. There you go. We've got a mixed race weddings of the royals, so it's become a full circle. But from America, Meghan, is it Meghan? Megan Markle Sparkle, and I've forgotten the name of the other person. So this is what a hoot watching that marriage. But they wanted to get married, and the law said they can't do it, and the judgment came in, and to see the judgment written as typed out, like with those old typewriters, saying that if God had wanted the races to marriage, that to intermingle, they wouldn't have put the Negro, the whites, the yellow people, the Malay. It just sort of like offended everyone possible. But beautiful with the United States coat of arms at the top, and said the marriage was illegal, and they were expelled from Virginia. If we are 1967, I can't comprehend this. Although there are examples of strange racial problems in Australia on this line, but it's nothing like this. And so this one court case was taken up to the Supreme Court, and they won, and they threw out this ruling. So this is the time of President Kennedy, at segregation. So getting people, allowing people to go to the school together. I don't know. And this mixed race thing happened, and it then threw open the door, making it legally in all states. So apparently there's a federal law can overrule state laws. And it's slightly different in Australia because there are state zones of competence and federal zones of competence in Australia. So it's a bit more stratified. You can't have, I suppose you could. It's like the federal one is all and about the federal powers under the Constitution. Well, that's about it. Yeah, that's a federal court going up. Now there's a sort of case unraveled. So you have at the start of America interracial marriage, and sort of the modern era of America interracial marriages. How many go? Oh my God, this car. Whew. Good stay here. Okay, that's spooky. It's not a car, but a bike. And you know, want to have the lights on. I think they saw me. What a spooky guy. it's really interesting parallel is of the American tobacco companies creating. They've got, it's amazing, these bikes with the new LED lights, incredibly bright lights. And of course there's still although it's very clear, there's still a little bit of mist from the back burning out here. And on a hot night, you won't see me out here because the place could go out and you're toast. It burns, it happens almost too quickly. Oh, sorry. To get going. It would sound as though I'm just really out of it. Of course, I was just through there climbing up a very steep gorge. It's interesting about how the interplay of commercial interests really get in and inject how tobacco marketing has actually got into the American culture, and you can see how they don't go. And you can see right here, the very first thing that the Americans are sensitized to is arms. Can we have your arms? No, you can't. the most important things to the American Indians was the arms. So you can sort of see how guns, really when they first go across, are the symbol of power and the symbol of white power in America, and the legitimization, I'm sort of going a little bit further than the documentary looking at guns and tobacco in there. And there is a sort of a very similar, but there are very similar parallels, and I'm sort of going a little bit beyond the documentary. Obviously the documentary was just for American consumption, but there's sort of similar parallels. Like in Australia, we had this situation called Terra Nullius, that the Aboriginals gave up their country, and there was no one here. It was an empty country, and the Aboriginals didn't show any signs of ownership, and therefore it's ours. And now, if you read the documents, this is clearly a fiction. If you read the Admiralty, they would say, how many troops do we need, or if we don't put that, we need this many to have power over them. And it's like, albeit it was dissimilar to, if you wanted to go to New Zealand or any other place, Australia had the advantage that the Aboriginals would think in a non-warlike fashion. and so there was this legal fiction in Australia that the Aboriginals just didn't want their land, and so we took them, and they just didn't exist legally until we started to undo it. And then there was this legal dispute that Mabo won up in the Thursday Islands. So it's really interesting. The Aboriginals couldn't do it, but there's a group of islands which are culturally distinct, and people were having an inter-regional dispute about who owned a particular part of land, and there was no the title. Oh well, it is interesting in that the title of land has to, in England goes right back to the Magna Carta or forever. Doesn't go, but in Australia we introduced a titles office in a process called the Torrens system. I think that's going around worldwide. So it's sort of a bit like patent law, but land. Sort of how to establish it. And, the federal government mucked up and said, you can't own that part of stuff because you have native title to it. And they went, oh shit. And, then the judges say, come on, say that. Argument again. They have native title to the land. And so with that, this single small patch of land led to, or whatever that could be, of Australia being handed back to the Aboriginal under called native title. That is, there's such a thing as native title, and they have it. It's their right originally. They've sort of mucked up the argument. And this dreadfully racist thing in America was a similar thing. By saying that you have a Pocahontas clause in this incredibly racist thing, and trying to enforce things against this tribe, you legally admit that this tribe exists. And of course, in the United States, it's apparently lots of groups try to say they're a tribe, and it's on their effort to try and prove it, and it's very hard to produce proof, but the proof that it exists is if the government has tacitly worked on the assumption of it. So, in essence, it's sort of really rather interesting in that the tobacco industry created America, or a lot of the structures in America, the bringing of tobacco and guns, there sort of created elements which went right through, and it's gone right through the American society, and they had these spooky statues. I traveling around the Soviet Union, you'd see these statues and you go, oh my god, these over-muscular, these wee Russians walking in front of these over-masculinized, strong pictures, sort of like the picture, the image is just an invention. And you see these scenes. I wish I could say there are similar things I've seen. It's in South Africa, there's the Vortrekker Monument, and this is, look, in Australia we have things to it, but the Dutch Vortrekkers have a sort of a similar twisted story. So then the entire basic thing is that in terms of stewardship of the planet, there's some certain things we got to lose. One is this make money quick, this idea that we're trying to get to the top of our prison system and stuff like that. But here it's interesting that that although tobacco ultimately destroyed this Indian group, it allows it to resurrect itself many years later by creating the prejudice which writes it. So it's not the history books which wrote it, it was the historic prejudice in American law which wrote it. So there's lots of things going across here, and I suppose one has to say what's interesting now is that the tobacco industry perhaps has gone, but the next industry of questionable marketing, let us not be too sanguine here. The Disney has sort of, although it's wholesome and pure, has got a whole heap of problems with it, and it's taken the legend and created McDonald's toys and the whole thing, and made it a sort of a safe in here. So you have Snow White, the dwarves, Pocahontas, blah, 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 Aladdin, and so all these things happening. It's sort of got the basic boy meets girl, some problem, some power structure have to go. It's the sort of basic Romeo and Juliet. And I think that's what they sort of could see, that there's a sort of a basic formula. And of course, once people know the formula, people can actually ignore the formula and look at the costumes or listen to the song, because they know what's going to happen. So there's that thing. It's sort of like the fast food, cultural fast food. Now, perhaps if you look on a much larger time scale, the travesty of what Disney is doing may eventually unlock the by little stages a more nuanced look at it. But of course, I mean, if we're building things for kids, there's sort of this idea that there is this bubble that you can only put pure things in for kids. So sort of, and you can see it in the science that we teach. There's, we teach this beer companies science because it's good for kids. It's what they like. They believe in the Tooth Fairy, Father Christmas, Easter Bunny, and Niels Bohr. Yeah, like this. You're going to argue against that? You bastard. That type of thing. So this all comes to me coming through now. Sort of cognitively, I have to... we're going to keep on walking along here, mate. Oof. But cognitively, I have to look at these. You can sort of see this high-level processing, which is really, you know, rubbish. It's almost noise compared to where I have to get cognitively. So I have to memorize or pick in a lot of greater detail. Talking through gets my cognitive pathways coming across, but look, it's a real long slog being able to structure communication, structure things up in one aspect of it. And then, so this is actually too easy because I can blab for an hour. It doesn't really matter. But in a document, how do you actually get that across in a document? And essentially, you have to go through and say, what are the key points? How can you actually make that key point in a non-confrontational but opening sense, and bring it through? That's still way beyond me. And of course, I've started doing the other cognitive exercises, and you know, there's just a huge mountain to climb. So although I might be good on memory, the association or distractors, it's just not up there. I just score appalling on it. So I'll have to do it. So that's Pocahontas for you. So essentially, someone who is young enough and trusted enough to be a translator, so has fallen in between the two worlds, learnt English and Algonquin, and therefore vital, and then this vital stuff becomes vital to the English, and so the English capture, keep her hostage, amplify her, and then use her as an advertising thing, where to a certain extent she's used. There's this point where they say, how come a hostage appears to go over to the other side? And they say, they pointed out Paddy Hearst, who was captured by a left-wing radical group, began to rob banks. She actually identified as the Stockholm syndrome. You know, my overall view is that, so the Stockholm syndrome is where you, basically capture someone from a different culture, different group, for this is all to do with power. You capture them and you take them into your society, and strangely they lose allegiance to the group they're in and start having allegiance with their captors. Now, I think that's a very basic thing. You're out of the savannah and you go, and you know, this is not the language and sophistication of history, and you capture a group. Now, at a certain point, they've got to stop fighting and assimilate in with the group. And there's this thing is a very natural thing, and that also is something which is sort of an underwritten anthropological thing which happens here. Now, again, in the Australian Aboriginals, that sort of thing naturally sort of happened in terms of that the people lost wandering in the Australian bush were just taken into the tribe and became part of the tribe for a while. You know, how did it happen? And then when they the English came across them, they would shoot the hapless European who'd begun living as an Aboriginal. That this very much happened in that people in founding of Melbourne. Was it Batman? He got stranded. Batman and someone else got stranded. One person died, an Aboriginal died. He picked up his spear, began to walk around, and because he's holding the spear of this person, obviously he doesn't look like him, he was interpreted as a ghost, can't come back. And so there's this entire sort of spiritual, shamanistic world in which the actual occupation of an individual is actually not sort of an individual concept, but they're actually a concept of continuity of the spirit world in the past spirits. And with that, there is this ability, like if you're fluid in your spirit environment, you're also spirit within groupings, and so you can actually move across it. Now, the thing is that this is actually quite, women who are sort of selected to live in various families do this. You know, this is quite a natural thing to happen. So these elements happening here, and I sort of detect it here in terms of we've got these political parties in Australia which have got horrendous track record with women and a horrendous way of treating them, horrendous powers that display, yet there's this, I'm not saying women are bad for supporting it, but there's this inability to articulate and to speak against it. It's in terms of that they're deaf to that that style of thinking, and then there's the we're almost captive to this culture, and you would sort of see this. I've reached this turnaround point here. Oh, okay, so I've reached. So this is a turnaround to Euroka, clearing up in the Blue Mountains. So Blue Mountains is a really interesting place. So I just put it aside. There's this little clearing further up, another sort of kilometre up the track, but you know, that's a big thing. It's actually a volcanic crater. Now, you would think that volcanic craters would be on the top of volcanoes, and there are in the Blue Mountains a few. Well, they're not craters. What's happened is that they've gone up and they've just oozed out, sort of a shield volcano, as it's called. So we've got a few shield volcanoes up there, not the classic Mount Fuji cone. Now, Mount Fuji is a series of, it's actually one cone and another cone built up, another cone built up. It's sort of three layers of cones built up, but it all looks like one single cone. And just the way it's that the craters have moved. You know. But here we've got shield volcanoes in the Blue Mountains and craters, not on the volcanoes, but deep in the valleys. And what's happened is there's, you know, this river sandstone, volcanic rocks come up, and the heat has suddenly hit the water, and it's expanded, and it's blown a crater, like a bomb crater. So it is a crater, but it's like this huge bomb crater, and there's, I don't know, at night, Twin Sea can be unlucky, but you walk along there, and you have to watch it, because on the road, just sitting very quietly, a kangaroo's now. I just see this light coming up here. I hope it's quite a distant thing, not someone coming up here, because it's something a little bit spooky. Coming across here. This it's got so many levels that to discuss and talk about. One of the things that I do find interesting is that I suppose I don't have enough authority or detail knowledge about the, like, I sort of know the big issues, but my sort of short-term knowledge means that I just really can't hold an argument with anyone. Look, thanks a lot for listening, and I'll...
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.